Greetings and welcome to the latest edition of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast. As always, I'm your host, Martin, and I'm very happy to have you with me today as we continue to dig into the backlog of interviews that I've had just waiting in the wings to come on out to all of you out there in listener land. This week, we've got Christy Myers, who works at Flow Integrative Ketamine in Encinitas, California. We actually had this conversation 2 months ago, so it's been just sitting there ready to come out for a little while, and today's the day. But first, of course, a few quick announcements. We'd like to thank Wes for making a contribution in support of the Entheogenic Evolution podcast over this past week. Thank you very much, Wes, for your many years of support in so many ways, and also the fact that you contribute via PayPal and also support me over at Patreon. And of course, thanks to all of my ongoing supporters over at my Patreon page. If you'd like to support this podcast, it's quite easy. Stop by my personal webpage, www.martinball.net, and use either the PayPal link or the Patreon link that are at the top right of the page, and choose the support level that works best for you, a one-off through PayPal, or come on over to Patreon and sign up at the monthly level that fits your level of support and interest and what you're able to do. And of course, it's always welcome, always appreciated. Also, I mentioned last week and just want to mention again that the new 5-MeO-DMT education website that has been put out by Joel and Victoria is up and running. And actually, we're in the works of getting a podcast with at least Victoria, perhaps Victoria and Joel, to talk about their website and also more about their retreat center that they're now working in Mexico, which, of course, where the Bridging Heaven event is going to be taking place, which was featured on the podcast just a couple weeks ago. So that's in the works. But in the meanwhile, you can check out the new 5-MeO-DMT education website. It is 5, written out, FIVE-MEO.education is the website for that. Of course, speaking of 5-MeO-DMT, I am always available for 30, 60, and 90-minute consultations to help you reflect on and integrate your experience. Of course, I specialize in 5-MeO-DMT, but I'm not in any way limited to that particular entheogenic molecule. More than happy to talk to you about any of your experiences across the psychedelic spectrum. And of course, field questions about non-duality and energetic embodiment and authenticity and all of those good, juicy things. Feel free to reach out, shoot me an email at martinwball@gmail.com or stop by at nondualentheogenicintegration.com if you'd like to see more about my services and reach out to me through there. Okay, let's go ahead and jump into our conversation with Christy. Again, her name is Christy Myers. She works for Flow Integrative. You can find the website at flowintegrativeketamine.com, and it's located in Encinitas, California. We spoke 2 months ago. Here's a conversation, and I'll also throw in one of my newer tracks off of my EP, When Nature Calls, at the end of this conversation for your listening enjoyment. Of course, you can find my music over at martinball.bandcamp.com. The soundtrack to Orbi's Vision is still available for a free download over there if you want to check that out and grab that. I'm going to make that available through the next week. And of course, you can find my music on Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, Amazon, all those places. Just know I'm not Martin come to the throne ball, that my music is not Christian praise and gospel, of course. Anyway, here's Christy Myers. Hope you enjoy our conversation. Be back next week with sharings from the audiobook to the Entheological Paradigm, Essays on the DMT and 5-MeO-DMT Experience and the Meaning of It All, 2021 edition. That's going to be our next audiobook that I will be sharing here on the podcast in between interviews. Okay, here's Christy Myers, Flow Integrative Ketamine. Christy Myers. So Christy Myers, you're joining me from Flow Integrative Ketamine Clinic in Encinitas, California, way down there, just over the border from Mexico. I'm sure it's sunny and warm down there.
Yes, it is.
Yeah. Where in Encinitas is your clinic located?
We're right off of El Camino Real, just a few minutes from downtown, about 10 minutes from the water. It's divine.
Sounds like a nice location. Currently, my 20-year-old daughter is attending UCD, so she's down there in San Diego.
Oh, wow.
I've been down there myself, but not too much. So I'm not all too familiar with the area, but
yeah, we're about 30 minutes, give or take, from downtown San Diego. So we're a little north.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's a lovely location. Southern California is always nice. Well, most of the time, except for the traffic.
I know it.
Traffic, way too much traffic. But yeah, let's just start with kind of introducing yourself to the audience. Okay. And then, of course, we're going to talk about the clinic. We're going to talk about ketamine. And, you know, I've got some questions about the different ways that ketamine is administered. And but let's go ahead and let's start with you, Chrissy. Tell us about yourself and kind of how you got into this space of working with ketamine for addiction, PTSD, anxiety, depression, you know, all the ones that everybody's suffering from these days.
Yeah, that's truth. Well, ketamine found me, in all fairness. So, and I'm happy to share that story. I've been in emergency medicine now since I was 18 years old. And I know what you're thinking. I look like I'm only in my 20s, but that's 20 years ago, right? So 22 years ago. And it was just a progression of the pursuit of medicine. I started as a wildland firefighter, which then led me into the medical side and the city side of fire, in which I worked for a county fire for several years, finding my way into the hospitals, onto the ambulances, then onto airships, and working in other institutions. I did a stint in the prison as an employee, not as I worked in special housing. And in that whole time as well, I was giving back. I really loved the educational piece. So I was also working part-time as a teacher. I did 20 years as a teacher. The last 10 of those really immersed in the classroom and with lecture, you know, just receiving tenure last year. So it really is multifaceted as far as the jobs and the roles that I have held over the last 20 years. And in addition to that, my mom had run restaurants from when I was little. So I started actually waitressing when I was 14 years old, which I really do think helped well-round my ability just to have conversation and connect with people.
Yeah.
So it's definitely a perk. Anyways, the last 3 years, really, ketamine found me. And what I mean by that is it entered our drug box as professionals. So in emergency medicine and as paramedics, we carry ketamine in the field to be able to administer it to patients for trauma. And I taught pharmacology. So therefore, as ketamine entered the classroom, I really had to take a step back and have some self-awareness in my own preconceived judgments. Ketamine caught me off guard, right? Well, we use opioids and we use benzos. We have Versed, we have morphine, we have fentanyl as a standard drug that we carry. And so by implementing ketamine, I really had to dive into what ketamine is at its source so that I could speak freely on it from a place of knowingness,
yeah.
If that makes sense.
Yeah, I'm really curious. So then, because I hadn't actually heard that before, that ketamine is now part of the emergency medical services toolkit. So, and what kind of conditions would that then be administered kind of out in the field as the ambulance rolls up?
Yeah, so it's acute trauma. So a traumatic incident, pain associated with abdominal pain, cancer, sickle cell. So any kind of crises with the involvement of pain because of its disassociative properties.
So then the ambulance rolls up, someone's in terrible traumatic pain. And so then what are they given? Intravenous injection of ketamine. And that actually helps sort of get them out of the immediacy of that pain so that then the doctors can work with them? Or is it to actually anesthetize them and kind of put them out, or just enter that dissociative state?
It's to enter that dissociative state. And here, that really is a beautiful question because I really put a lot of time and heart into the awareness that the guys had. And I say guys loosely in the sense that it really is a male predominant field.
Yeah.
Occasionally we'd have women in there. I've been called sir more times in my professional career because I was the only woman for so long in that realm.
Really? It's, so, it's just like automatic is yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Yeah. And I'm like, come on. Like, I get it. It's part of our program. So with that being said, I really put a lot of emphasis on what and how ketamine works. And it really is disassociating them from the event. And I use my mom as an example in this. She was in a traffic accident on the freeway in which the impact pinned her door. And when it pinned her door, the airbag deployment put off so much of its dust, if you will, that the powder resembled smoke to her, mm-hmm. and her door was trapped. And in that, she now has anxieties of just even simply getting on the freeway. The thoughts of it alone create PTSD. And so we really do are... I put a lot of heart and energy into making sure that the guys and girls knew that when we show up on a call, we're literally their point of coming back to a whole different reality outside of the event, and how profound that is in the psychogenic realm of our profession. And when we administer ketamine, we're not just necessarily disassociating them from the physical pain and embodiment, but we're also dissolving that attachment to the event.
Yeah.
Which is powerful. Because I can only imagine if my mom could have received this modality, what that would have done with her connection piece to that accident and now her apprehensions years later to even get on the freeway or think about the freeway without already cultivating those same emotional responses, which is the trigger sums of PTSD. It's vast in our PTSD, right? Depending on the complexity of the trauma. But in an emergency case, it really is powerful of how we're using ketamine. And it's a drip. It's something that we're given in amount of fluid. So it's not an IV push or something that's given really quickly. It's given over time, which is beautiful, which allows them to come to slowly go into an altered state of consciousness.
Yeah. Because, of course, someone who's experiencing a trauma, you don't want to like immediately rip them out of their situation. But it does sound that the immediacy of it, in the sense that it's able to be applied right then and there in the field, has some profound therapeutic benefits, and that it helps to create that removal from the traumatic event itself. Because, of course, I'm sure with a lot of people who are coming, say, into the clinic, they've probably had the PTSD in many cases for a long time, and it's about events that happened at some point in the past. But here it's kind of this immediate intervention that kind of helps break that chain of ingrained trauma and then the patterned behavior that develops around that trauma, that it can actually short circuit that trauma response process in a way that's powerful for people.
Exactly. It's beautiful. And where there just needs to be more education, which I plan to put that content out, is really teaching providers how to ground patients once we disassociate, because we're removing the limbic system, right? And the limbic system houses the amygdala and the hippocampus, which are huge emotional centers in the human body. And so when we disengage that limbic, not only are we creating a disassociative in the physical body, but we're allowing you to move through your unconscious mind. And in that, that's the variable, depending on where you are in your evolution of human in consciousness. And so some, they respond by seeing people who have maybe passed away before. It's a variable, right? And if you don't have supportive care, and I could only imagine you're in the back of an ambulance, there's major lights down on you, or you're being wheeled into an emergency room, and that's also super impactful and influential into your experience.
Yeah.
And so how do you ground them? How do you really let them know that they're safe and encourage them to even surrender to closing their eyes and not allowing the environment to influence their experience, which can also be impactful. So there's facets to it, but there's also an area that's still a little taboo in our field, which is sadness. Mm. And so you want to clear a room real quick, you talk about sadness. And so to allow people to just feel is uncomfortable for us as professionals, right? It's emergency driven. I come in and I go out. And so to sit in a sadness component does take some specialness in that, or just some retraining our essential compensatory mechanisms, which is to avoid.
Yeah. Wow. I really want to chime in on that, that I think that it's just such a powerful thing to hear, that we need to make space and make room for sadness, especially when we're dealing in healthcare or mental health or emotional health realm. You know, I just think about how, you know, when you have conversations with people and someone actually reveals that maybe they're not quite so happy, or there's something that's uncomfortable or difficult in their life, that so often we come back with, oh, but you're good, right? Oh, but you're okay, right? And so we have this kind of this imposition on this idea that we don't want to deal with sadness and that actually you're okay, but that in the therapeutic space, what becomes transformative for a lot of people is actually really fully encountering their sadness and encountering their pain in a way that's powerful. And if it can be supportive and not chase the therapist out of the room, it's what people need a lot of times, you know, that space to cry, that space to feel, and not just, but it's okay, you're okay, it's all right. Yeah.
And that really is what the driving force is of my creation. I watched not only my students, but in the field. So it is a very beautiful relationship that was cultivated. I mean, I ran these programs for a year in total, and I would have anywhere from 20 to 45, 50, sometimes 80 students, depending on how many programs were running concurrently. And in that, I'm very vulnerable and transparent in the way that I practice my lectures and how I deliver information. I believe that it's mutualism and it's simpatico. Here's the bar. I started to practice the Pygmalion effect, which is a whole nother topic. But as I love you where you're at, and show me what you can do. Here's the bar, get there integrously, right? And so they really started to open up, or you could see where they felt safe enough to share. And I was having students who were attempting suicide, or I would have students call me in the middle of the night and say, hey, I can't get a hold of so-and-so, and they're posting some really dark stuff, or hey, so-and-so shared this with me. And it just became so obvious of how much the crisis is in our field outside of what was already being, you know, seen. But we chalk it up to the stressors, right? Like, oh, they're in school, and why did you get into this field? And more times than not, Martin, we're here because we needed to become who we needed when we were little.
Yeah.
And when we embark on this field, we want to give and we want to show up and we want to care. And what happens is we're also constantly reminded of the trauma that we also endured, which is a constant provocator into PTSD, anxiety, and depression. But we're the help.
Yeah.
And so now there's the conundrum. If I called 911, I'm showing up. So who helps the help? Which started my mission.
Yeah, well, let's talk about that, because that is such an excellent point to raise, that people who work in these fields often have their own past history of trauma or difficulty, and that they have found some process that helps them. But then you become someone who facilitates for others and who helps others. And as you say, you've been a teacher and working with students going through this process. And then, I mean, how do you even deal with the fact that you hear that, oh, some of my students might be suicidal, that they're having these problems? you know, that it kind of goes back to that thing like, oh, you're okay, right? Like, so the teacher is supposed to be okay, but what if the teacher's not okay? What if the teacher's having an emotional response or a traumatic response to this? And so we get into the, sort of this fractal enfoldment of who's caring for the carers, who are caring for the carers, who are caring for the carers, you know?
Right.
So how do you care for yourself then?
For myself, it's meditation. It's human connection. So I am a mom as well. I have two of the grooviest kids who are my greatest teachers and my greatest triggers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, kids.
Yes, right? They show me every place that I still need healing, right? And in that, we have a mantra in my house, and my students used to always really enjoy this too, whether it was in poking fun at or truly embracing, but we are the drugs. It's one of my favorite lectures. And how do we cultivate those emotional centers through connection and communication, vulnerability? 10 hugs a day is what is the daily recommended amount. Some literature says 8. I like to round it at 10. 10 heart-to-heart, 20-second hugs allows oxytocin to normalize in the body. And if you're not receiving that connection daily, then you become deficient, which is where we lack luster and intimacy and love, right? It's cultivated through connection. And in that, I practice it in my home. My kids and I, we have a deal. If we haven't had 10 heart-to-heart hugs, they have full permissions to snuggle me all night long so that they get that titrated dose over the night. Right? And we would practice that in the classroom as well, too. Truly being able to hug and show up for each other. Vulnerability, transparency. We would do it every day that we were in togetherness. Share what it is that's on your heart, or is there something that you're contemplating? What is it? You know, what struck you this week, or what calls did you run that are still troublesome, or what do you want to talk about? It's talk about it Tuesday, right? And we would just throw all those concepts out so that we did deepen connection, which is crucial in the mission, which is still my mission to this day. Right? But just in a different fashion. So it's important to be able to just raise awareness of the things that we need, the adrenaline side, how we can release energy, excited energy, what it means to have human connection, to nurture your body, to hydrate your body, the basic needs that we take for granted. So right now my piece is hugging my kids, yeah. Right? Because we really are we're in this in togetherness for sure. We're breaking generational trauma on purpose. And meditation is something I absolutely love and appreciate every morning and every night. And then the ability to serve. I mean, this is my heart and passion of what I have created. And this, it's not like going to work, right? This is my purpose. And so I show up every day full of just gleaming with love, because this is where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah. I can see that from you.
Thank you.
And I really love that you're emphasizing here, you know, just with your children. And also you mentioned with your students, just the ability to give hugs. I mean, this is something like this basic human connection has gotten so fundamentally disrupted over these past few years with coronavirus and this ability to connect and to have those heart-to-heart moments and that physical sense of touch. And you know, maybe we can get into how this might play out in the clinic. I have some other questions I want to get to before we get there. But I think that it's something that sometimes is neglected in these sort of the psychedelic healing space, is kind of addressing how do we deal with physical touch and physical contact and those heart-to-heart moments that can occur that can be very powerful for people. But kind of before we get into the clinic and how things work there, I did want to return to something that you mentioned a little bit earlier, that you were talking about the amygdala. Maybe I'm probably mispronouncing that, but I'm interested. So in your own research into ketamine, if you could just share with us, how is it that ketamine is working physiologically. What's going on in the brain and in the body that is allowing for this altered state to release trauma and pain and these things?
That's one of my favorite questions.
Okay, good.
You can tell by the gleam of smile on my face, right? This is also where it needs to be prefaced to dissolve all of our belief systems so that we can be open to receive new information, right? If you look at our human brains, and I would love to send you some pictures on this, but we have a reptilian brain. Mm-hmm. We have a mammalian brain, and we have a human-y brain, right? And the reptilian brain is one of the pieces in our evolution if we were to had continued down the path of expansion in consciousness and transcendence or evolution in our brain development. The reptilian brain, as it ties in, it is the ability to keep us in survival, which we're all in deeply. Deeply right now, which keeps us in hurry and worry and keeps us in these loops. And so the way the medicine works is it goes in and it dissolves that center. It disassociates that component of the human brain to where now the mammalian brain, which is beautiful in design, which allows us to be autonomic in our functionality, meaning it doesn't impact the way that we breathe. It doesn't impact the way that we beat and our heart. It doesn't impact any of the physiological responses of the body that we take for so granted in our human experience. Never at night do we go to bed and we're like, I better set my heart to beat and I better set my lungs to breathe and I hope I make digestive enzymes tonight, you know? We take for granted so much of how intelligent our body is. And so we disengage the limbic, which takes survival out of the equation, which then takes the power away from the networks that have been created. And those networks that have been created are from seared events, and it's from firing and wiring emotional centers, which is feelings and thoughts, as two separate pieces of information that enter our awareness and our emotional states. And those start getting fired and wired from when we're in utero. And even more so, when I was inside of my mom, my daughter was inside of me. It's cellular. It's deeply cellular of how much we are influenced by our environment and the words around us. And so when the medicine makes its way into your body, it dissolves that center. And as it dissolves that center, it is the most archaic and original place of stored emotions, amygdala, hippocampus. So we're disengaging the way that emotions influence the way that we think. And by doing such, there's a liberation of energy that occurs because now I'm no longer in survival. Now my body is able to go into its autonomic state. And so the medicine has multifacets of usage or its benefit in session. One is that it allows us to start to restore. It allows us to go into a parasympathetic state that has the body in rehabilitation. So now I am healing. We're the answer. I mean, we are so beautiful by design. We heal ourselves all the time. We have people that can help course that path. We can set a bone, but it's truly us that heals, right? And so the body starts to begin to repair itself physiologically, neurologically, spiritually, all realms. And in that, the medicine meets you where you're at and what you're ready to be able to see, because the answer is inside of all of us intimately. And so as we disengage that center that influences survival, influences hurry and worry, influences speed and aggression, we're now allowed to see our loving creation as an observer. And so now we're watching ourselves as a participant, and not in a victimized state. We realize things happened to us, not because of us. And in that, there's a liberation. There's a liberation in energy from stored emotions that have been trapped and influenced in the body that present as physical pain. And then the other side is becoming the observer to see that it happened to you, not because of you, which is where deep forgiveness comes in. And there's no other way other than the answers that are intimate to you. And I say that loosely in a sense, because there is other ways with meditation, right, or heavy self-reflection, but we need a catalyst, and that catalyst is psychedelics, the things that allow us to have an altered state of consciousness on purpose. And each psychedelic has its own intimate, beautiful gift. And in this, with ketamine, we disengage that reptilian center, survival. We go into thrive as an observer, and it's breathtaking. It's unbelievably intimate, and it's individualized to the sense that we're all walking each other home. Ram Dass is an amazing teacher for that, but truly we are all one. Whatever I heal in me, I also heal in you. And so it's the ability to truly embrace that here and now, so that people do feel safe to surrender, so that there's no resistance in the experience and you have curiosity to explore yourself.
Yeah. So let's talk about what that looks like, how that presents specifically with ketamine. So, you know, I've talked to lots of people who work in psychedelic therapy space, and some people emphasize sort of somatic releases, things that are happening in the body. Other times we have big emotional releases, big outpourings. Then, of course, you know, we have the more classic purging that takes place, you know, people throwing up or people having diarrhea, depending on, you know, what medicine they were working with. So when we're talking about ketamine, and when you're describing the release of these stored energies and these stored patterns and these emotional responses, how does that look in the context of a ketamine clinic? And so maybe even to back up, we could then talk about, you can choose which one you want to start with first, but how the clinic is actually set up, how a session is set up, and then what someone goes through as they have these different kinds of releases and transformations. So you can pick that up wherever you like.
Yeah, well, it's very intimate. So we spend a lot of time on the front end allowing people to connect with us. Mm-hmm. It's a sacred energy exchange. We don't leave your side. So we're in here the whole time with you so that you know that you are safe through the entire journey, which I think is very crucial to the mission. And in that, we do preparatory work. So you meet with me first, and we have conversations so that we really connect, and there's transparency. Because once you pierce the veil of a new reality, it's hard to unsee, right? And so to really know what it is that you're prepping for or what you're embarking on as a self-exploration and expansion in consciousness, which then allows you to transcend a reality. And some for us, that reality is anxiety. Some is depression. Some is what you fill in the blank, right? Because we all struggle in one way or another. And so how do we have transcendence? And so that's a beautiful conversation initially. You then spend an hour with our therapist so that you also really get to know, and we get to know what it is you're looking to accomplish with the medicine. From there, you also do another prep session to where now we're revisiting all the information we gave you because there are new questions that may arise or whatever that may look like. And then we give you lots of resources, documentaries, books, meditations, pieces to really plan you out, and where I'll create you a plan, whether that's 6 weeks, 8 weeks, 12 weeks. What does that look like for your journey? And how you're going to move through the medicine and how we support you in that. And then you meet with our docs. So whether the doc is in-house or a virtual meeting, but there's always a doc here as well too, just for all intent and purpose. And then the session itself is 2 hours. So you come in, whether you're supported by family as they bring you in, but you need to have a ride, then we let you settle in. So there's a beautiful window of time where we either take 20, 30, 40 minutes in the front end to allow nervous energy to settle, to connect with breath and really tap in. And then we start the medicine, which the medicine's a 40-minute infusion. And then from there, we allow you to unfold and close, whether that's journaling, whether that's conversation, whether that's sitting in silence and meditation. What do you need and how can we support you? So there's not a forced or a rigid approach in that. It's adaptability intimately to what you need. Mm-hmm. And then you have a snack.
Which is always grounding. It's always good.
It is. Yeah. It so is.
Yeah. After a big psychedelic journey, I like to call it tasty reality bites.
Yeah. I like that. Yeah. You really, some people come up, they're like, I am so hungry. It's like, well, yes, you just traveled the cosmos. And so therefore it's energetically exhausting, right? One of the biggest pieces in this, Martin, and it comes into our profession as well too, right? Or as emergency providers, we become so enmeshed in the hurry and worry that we actually learn how to bypass our basic needs, right? Yeah. I can't think about procreation, digestion, or even feeding parts of myself, drinking water. None of that pertains when I'm in hurry and worry. I don't even think about it. You'll hear nurses say that they'll hold their urine, trying to think of the right word to say there. I gotta keep it G-rated. They'll hold it for 12 hours, a whole shift, because literally you don't even come up. You have to make a choice, right? Do I want to drink water? That means I have to go pee. And if that's the case, right, we're one of the most self-sacrificing professions. So we learn how to override ourselves. And over time, it just becomes innate. We can go 12 hours without eating. We can go 12 hours. We don't even think about it. We're like, oh, shit, did I have lunch today?
Yeah.
Hmm. And so in this, you become autonomic. You're able to go into R&R. It's a transcendental timeout. And by doing that, your body's like, oh, she got out of the way. I was so hungry. We don't even know that that's occurring because we override our system constantly. The same thing goes for intimate. I mean, we lose the luxury organs, and which is also a crisis right now in this day and age with testosterone and intimacy.
Yeah. Well, it something that really strikes me about sort of this methodology of serving people is that fundamentally what you're offering is the opportunity to take time to simply have an experience. And it seems very simple in that sense, but just as you're describing that so much of our society is built around basically keep your head down, keep pushing forward. And I think it really goes all the way back into our Puritan founding of, you know, idle hands or the devil's playground, and this idea that we've always got to be productive, we've always got to be working. And even in the realm of healthcare, there is this idea of, well, when I go to the doctor, I want something to happen. I want to receive something or achieve something, or I want the right test, or I want the data. And so there's all this sort of goal-oriented notions of achievement, and which continues to push the stress buttons, continues to push the accomplishment and the doing buttons. But here, what you're offering is, well, let's take a couple hours where you can just relax, be with people that you trust, be with people who are supporting you, and then you're going to sink into this experience, and you're going to have this experience, and then things will reset on their own by giving yourself the gift of time and an altered state of consciousness. Because when we're locked into, as you say, this survival mode, that we're locked into a very particular kind of consciousness that has its realm of functionality, but it doesn't necessarily serve the whole human being, which is what I think everybody who works in this field, we all want to serve the whole human being. And that goes all the way into, as you say, the reality that we are all one, and that these experiences where we can really come to know that intimately and then see the reflection of, oh, my healing is healing for others and their healing is healing for me, because we really are all one. But if we don't make time to enter into these states, we're not going to have that relief that comes from that. Mm-hmm. And so it's kind of about making space for people to give themselves the gift of just having an experience.
Yeah. Truth.
Yeah.
It's beautifully said. Yeah. Yeah, you're absolute. It's a gift. And it's an honor for myself and my team to hold this sacred space. For everything we heal here, it heals for all of us. And that includes my children. That includes all the it includes everyone, right? And so in this creation, to really allow transcendence and connection and healing innately, it benefits everyone. It's with my whole heart. It's an honor. And that is how that's how we practice here. That's the mantra, is to do no harm and to really bring awareness into the psychedelic space, because that word in itself is also kind of intimidating, which is probably why I find it to be so liberating, because I've been told that I am intimidating for a lot of my life. It's like, well, why, right? That word in itself, it has a lot of aversion. I mean, even my mom it doesn't sit well with her. She's like, hippies. And I'm like, what do you mean hippies? Sure. Thank you. That's a compliment, right? I find it fascinating. It really is. It's sacred work, and it's a liberation of energy. I mean, that's one of my next areas of study, is truly that, the energetic release that occurs. It is somatic. I have physically watched energy liberate from body. You move through a lot when you can get out of your own way. And it takes a catalyst. And to know that that catalyst, one, can be by choice and courage of having a psychedelic experience on purpose, with purpose, or the universe does it by design, and we've kind of cliched this, it comes in threes, and that's in tragedies, right? The universe will shake you to wake you, period. And I'm telling you, coming out of suffrage and rock bottom is not an easy thing to do. And so there's only a couple choices in this human experience, and our mission in my heart is growth. And it's not change. I think change is an uncomfortable word, because that means that you're not good enough,
right?
That's not true, right? It's evolution and growth. And the way that we grow after we've grown, right, in our physical body, we equate growth, I think, to childhood and certain groovy numbers that we've established, right? Like, we really celebrate 5. And then we really celebrate 10, because now you're double digits, right? And then we celebrate 13. And then 16 is huge for a car. And then 18 is, how come you're not out of my house? And then 21 is, here comes the booze. And next thing you know, it's dirty 30. And you're like, what is happening? And you're trying, after the numbers, right? Then we start to even really have a poor relationship with the numbers as we age. But it's in, the truth of it is growth. And so when we stop physically growing, where's the growth? And the growth is in the mindset. We're still unfolding neurologically until we're 35. And so in that, our brain is constantly in growth. So what are we doing to cultivate new neural pathways? Outside of maybe brushing our teeth with the opposite hand. So really, it's evolution and growth. It's expansion in consciousness. It's drugs on purpose. Yeah. And it's really cultivating love as who we are without judgment. It's permission to surrender. It's permission to cry.
Yeah. So I want to come back to that question of what the releases are looking like, how that takes place within this context. And so just to give you some of my own context, I worked in the realm of facilitating 5-MeO-DMT, which is like high velocity medicine. And and I can use myself actually as a good example. So the first full experience I had of 5-MeO-DMT, you know, within seconds, it was, okay, I'm dying. And this is awesome, because I'm just going into this oneness. And kind of even how you say, you know, people get a little edgy around the word psychedelic, that for me was like, oh my God, it's God. Mm-hmm. Oh my God, it's God. And so then I started, before then, I was like one of these people like, please don't use the word God around me. Like, we could talk about source or universal consciousness, but don't use the word God. But that's what just came out of my mouth as this was opening. I was like, oh, thank you, God. Thank you. I was so grateful for this experience. And it was ecstatic, blissful, and just absolute, pure, unadulterated, unconditional love. So that was my first mm-hmm. experience. Then a month later, I went back and I had my second experience. And there, I could tell within seconds that I was holding on. And I expressed that to the other people in the room who were there witnessing for me. And I said, I'm holding on and I don't know why. And they said, oh, it's okay, Martin. It's okay. And I said, oh, it's okay. And so then I just started wailing and crying and wailing and crying and wailing and crying, and just years and years and years of pent up sadness, going back to that word, sadness, that I had never allowed myself to express or experience. I had hidden it away. I had hidden it from myself. I had hidden it from everybody in my life. And now it was just all pouring out of me. And then by the end of that, I was suckling like a little baby, rolling on my back. And it felt like every molecule of my being was being tickled, and that I was nursing from the breast of the great cosmic mother. And I just felt like all the nourishment I could ever need is available right here in every moment, because I am that and this is me. And so it was this powerfully transformative healing event, but it was facilitated through the release of that pent up energy that had to come out as the wailing and crying, and then this embodiment of sort of this archetypal babiness. And then as someone who facilitated 5-MeO, I mean, I saw everything from people throwing up all over themselves, people trying to run away, people trying to fight, people acting out, people stripping off all their clothes, people screaming at the top of their lungs, you know, so I got used to sort of this high intensity of energetic releasing. But my impression of ketamine, that it's not quite that. So that's why I kind of keep coming back to this question of what does it look like as people are releasing and having these experiences?
Yeah. And well, DMT sourced, right? So just a preface on DMT, because I absolutely love DMT. The entrance or the entry point to DMT is at 49 days in utero, and it enters into consciousness through the pineal gland. So we are struck with a bolus of DMT through the pineal gland, 49 days in utero. It's what concepts consciousness, and in that same moment, gender. We are DMT. And the ability to have it synthetically or synthesized is one, right, that we're experiencing. But 5-MeO is from Toad. And how we came to find that out, I would love to meet the men and women who had courage to explore psychedelics prior to us writing any books on it or having any forms of knowingness. So when DMT enters the human body, there's an ascension, and that ascension truly pulls you up into the highest quantum realms of existence, which is the cosmos, which is where oneness and God allows us to see. And that in itself is the great mystery. That's why we refer to it as the spirit molecule, right? And how powerful it is, right? I don't know why I'm always called to say she, but it feels so much in femininity, right? So ketamine, by disengaging that reptilian side of our human, allows us to travel the cosmos just as the same. And in that, you walk through your mind on your way there. And so rather than that massive ascension, that quickening that occurs when we go from this consciousness into the cosmic consciousness of the most optimized, highest self, it's a very short-acting trip. And in that, it just brings into your awareness, there's a whole nother realm. There's a whole bunch of other realms, right? And I truly also believe that DMT depending on who you talk to, they get pulled through certain ascension realms. And if you enter DMT at a level of consciousness that needs to pull you through some darkness, that's also experienced, right? So again, even DMT meets you where you're at,
yeah,
which is powerful. And then ayahuasca really churns from the inside, which is where we also have all this muck and buildup from stagnated energy from the lymphatic system, from the digestive system, from poor motility. And she just goes in there and churns and yearns and then purges all of the muck, which is powerful, which is why some have to go through many, many, many sessions to just get through the density of how much we've harbored internally. And they all have their gift. We all are going to the same place, which is the cosmos and our highest self. Ketamine allows you to, I've had one client tell me it's like taking a walk or a drive through my own mind. And so then it allows you to truly go through the levels of consciousness of those stored energy centers. If you're familiar with a trickle charger, have you ever like quads or dirt bikes, you can clip on a charger that just has a trickle response to constantly keep it charged if you're not using it. That's really how I see the emotions, like you were saying, that get trapped. They leach into our system. They're energetically charging our nervous system at all times because we've compartmentalized them. And so ketamine, it really does start to bask those areas. It allows you to expand your core wounds outwardly. And as we dissolve the energetic influence from the limbic brain or the reptilian brain, that no longer has influence. So now those core wounds are able to come up and out. And each and every time you sit with the medicine, there's a new liberation of energy from this surrender and release of those deepest and most intimate stored memories. And it's in through the form of energy. It influences our nervous system all the time. It's a leech. Right? It literally is leaching energy into the nervous system. We're recalibrating our nervous system without that influence or energetic bond, which is so powerful, which is why we have you sit with the medicine multiple times so that you can first sift through the day to day, right? It's like closing out all the tabs. You're like, holy moly, how many things was I thinking about up here? And then the next time it's a deeper dive. And then each and every time you then tap on core. And now that you're liberating the energy outwardly into the neural circuitry, that core wound is now padding internally. So it's raising itself and no longer influencing the nervous system as powerfully as it once did. And now we're creating and cultivating our reality using our wounds and our past as wisdom, no longer as a narrative of victimization, because our relationship with it has changed.
Yeah. Well, I really like the vocabulary that you use here, because it's very reflective of the vocabulary that I use as well, that I like to say that when we are consciously using these medicines, you know, not just, and I also think there's plenty of room just for fun, for exploration, for creativity, but if you're really using them consciously to bring yourself, as you say, into a place of growth and into a place of evolution, that the process of liberation is an energetic reformatting that takes place. Mm-hmm. And I always like to emphasize that it's really taking place within the body, that I think a lot of people in the psychedelic realm, they kind of get stuck with the idea of getting insights and downloads and having mental events. And I always want to bring it back to, well, all the crap you're carrying around, it's actually stored in your body, and it's mm-hmm. emphasized and reinforced by your thought patterns and behavioral patterns, but it's all in the body. And so this is where we really need to address the issue to allow the energetic reformatting to take place so that we can have a liberated individual who has been healed and is now into their growth mode of expansion and expanding awareness and understanding. And ultimately, it's about opening the heart and opening to the true nature of love.
Yeah. Because love is who we are.
Yes.
Yeah. Exactly. Love cannot be taken away and or given. It's simply what we are in existence. And it's one hell of a journey to get there. I can share a small piece of just my journey.
Oh, please.
When I was a little girl, my dad took his life. I was 15 years old when he committed suicide. And in that, I see how much that influenced my belief systems, just from the way that it was handled. No one wanted to talk about it.
Yeah.
We avoided it at all costs. We blamed it on all these other things outside of the fact that truly it is the, in my opinion, the final symptom of sadness.
Yeah.
And how that coursed so many of my actions, how that coursed my belief system, how it cultivated so much shame to even talk about how I lost my dad when it was referenced or asked or up in conversation. I would say things like asphyxiation or heart failure, which were along the lines of truth, but not the truth, right? Because there was so much shame associated with saying the word suicide.
Yeah. And it's just reinforcing the wound, isn't it? By not really calling it what it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then deepening the shame associated with it, because it comes down to thinking I wasn't good enough to live for.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there is so much in just vulnerability of our truth. And that's what is encouraged. It's what's your truth and how vulnerable do you want to be? Because otherwise the medicine will show you what it needs to show you. We talk about intentions as well. And I love intentions as a whole, but really the intention should be love, to initially sit with the medicine, because you don't know what your intention is until after you have your experience. And now you're coursing a whole new path. So after I sit with the medicine, my intention is to be more present with my body.
Yeah.
And really paying attention to how we carry tension.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, the medicine gives you room to breathe, right?
Yeah.
We take that speed and aggression and reset it. So now I can see when I'm triggered. I have a period of time when I feel my nervous system engaging in this trigger, which then shows me that it's a trigger. And so now I have room to make a choice. That's practicing the pause. And if I can practice a pause and I don't respond, and if I don't respond, I don't energetically exchange in a trigger, which then hurts the people that I love.
Yeah.
It gives you a whole new realm.
Yeah. And it's really that refocusing on the immediacy of the embodiment and what we are feeling energetically within ourselves, and whether we allow the trigger to create the cascade of reaction and projection and assumption, or can we give ourselves space to feel what we're feeling and then choose consciously how to move forward from a place of authenticity, vulnerability, love, genuineness. And I love how you emphasize this idea, you know, with intentions, because this is another place where I like to tell people, like, well, I want to emphasize the intention of just being present with what is. Because sometimes when people come for psychedelic therapy, they say, well, I want to work on this and I want to work on that and I've got this idea. And a lot of times that's just the ego perpetuating its own story of what it thinks it needs. And as you say, the medicine will really show you what you really need, but it's important just to be present with it, just to give your attention and focus and become aware of, oh, now I'm indulging in my projections, or now I'm retreating from fear, or now I'm projecting judgment, or whatever it may be. Mm-hmm. And so we become aware of how we're embodying ourselves as these beings of energy. And for me, ultimately, that energy is love, right? As you say, we are love. Love is energy. We are that. So how do we be with the energy that we are, and that it's so wonderful that reality comes with these tools like ketamine and other psychedelic tools to give us that opportunity to have that energetic reformatting and recalibration.
Yeah, it's a gift. Truly is a gift. The use of ketamine has been around for 60 years, which is amazing. And it is of Earth, right? I'll send you a really beautiful article to show where it occurs in nature. And in that, we really, it's amazing how much influence just saying ketamine has for where our mindsets go. I really don't remember the propaganda. I don't remember the programming. But really, the first thing that comes up when you hear ketamine is like, isn't that a horse tranquilizer?
Yeah.
Or Special K? Or is that date rape? Like, what is it? And it's like, well, it could be all of those things based off the intentions, which I think also is where intentions start to feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Because of how it's like when we use the word manipulation. I would teach drug manipulation. And I would emphasize, in this case, manipulation is for the greatest good, not to manipulate you into harm. Because manipulation is also a really uncomfortable word. So can intentions, right? Because it is in the intention of how we use the medicine. And then really reevaluating where our inner dialogue comes from, what that programming was, why we feel certain ways about certain drugs, and why? So that's the questions, right? People are like, oh, I would never do that. And you're like, okay. So I would encourage us to look at what we have aversions to. One of the practices, just to remove judgment, and this goes back into my classroom, we would talk about heroin, we would talk about overdoses, and the tragedies thereof. And occasionally there would be words that weren't in alignment with life, right? Judgments or whatever. And it was like, well, that's like having somebody come in here and judge us for eating our cup of noodles or our Uncrustables. Or, you know, it's like, at what point do we decide what's good and what's bad? Addiction is addiction is addiction. And we don't ever talk about the addiction to this little guy.
Yeah.
Which my phone, I mean, we're highly addicted to this thing. The same thing of food. We are morbidly, obesely addicted to food to the point of death. That's an uncomfortable conversation. And yet still we avoid it. You know, alcohol, the same thing. I mean, look how many people die daily from alcoholism. And it's just like, at what point are we going to change this narrative and become open to expansion of consciousness? Otherwise, it is the definition of insanity, because we're going to continuously keep doing the same thing and wondering why nothing changes.
Yeah, got to break the cycle somewhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Truth.
Well, Chrissy, it's really been a pleasure speaking with you. I think that we could probably just keep going. I know that you allotted an hour for the interview today, so I do want to let you go and get back to the rest of your day.
Appreciate you.
At work. But let's just remind everyone about where you are and about Flow Integrative. So if people want to reach out, if they want to connect, if they want to receive treatment, how would they go about doing that?
Yeah, you can call or text. The number is 909-735-FLOW, which is a really groovy and easy number to remember. And the universe wanted us to have that number as well. We're in Encinitas, California. And our website is flowintegrativeketamine.com. You can email me as well, too. It's hello@flowintegrativeketamine.com.
Oh, well, that's nice and friendly.
Yeah. Thank you.
Well, thank you so much for your time today, Chrissy. I really enjoyed speaking with you. And again, it's Chrissy Myers from Flow Integrative in Encinitas, California. Thank you for being a guest on the Entheogenic Evolution podcast.
I appreciate you, Martin. Thank you for having me.
Okay.